The season for planting is finally here. Next comes the season for fighting weeds. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day. This hour, Bob Hartzler, Iowa State University Extension weed specialist, will be here. We'll talk about doing battle with volunteer trees and invasive species like multiflora rose and honeysuckle. We'll also talk about milkweed, a weed that many homeowners are now trying to encourage. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Bob will answer your questions about the plants in your life. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be with us in a few minutes when we open the phones. We're going to start the hour with our never-ending battle against weeds. Bob Hartzler, Iowa State University Extension weed specialist, is here. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And when we talk about weeds, our decisions about what make a plant good and what make a plant bad seem to be somewhat arbitrary in some cases. So how do you define a weed?
Well, a lot of people would say it's a plant out of place. And weed scientists usually don't like that definition, since any plant occasionally will appear where it's not intended to be. But very few plants have the ability to persist and establish themselves permanently in those areas that they're out of place. So, you know, I think a definition of that a lot of people use would be it's a plant that interferes with human activities. I work primarily in agriculture, so we look at weeds that invade corn and soybean fields and cost farmers both in terms of yield and then cost them a lot of money to try to control those weeds.
And what makes the environment that we plant corn and soybeans, that we plant our gardens in, that we put our landscape plants in, what makes this environment so very welcoming to what we call weeds?
Well, weeds basically are plants that are adapted to disturbed habitats. And so any place humans disturb the native vegetation, that opens up bare ground, and Mother Nature doesn't like bare ground because that soil is prone to erosion. And so prior to, you know, humans coming in and disturbing the habitat, weeds would be the plants that moved into areas where, let's say, you had a flood and the flood wiped out all of the existing vegetation, so you had bare soil. And so plants such as the pigweeds, ragweeds, those are native species that would be the initial colonizers of those disturbed habitats.
Let's talk about some of the other kinds of plants that maybe they don't fit necessarily into that weed category, but we find ourselves battling volunteer trees in if you're reconstructing a prairie or you're putting in a windbreak, that kind of thing. You have trees that will grow out of place. You'll have different kinds of invasive species that move in. So let's talk about in a windbreak type environment, when you have volunteer trees that you don't want in there, what do you do?
Okay, you know, what we try to do initially is, you know, create an environment that's less prone to invasion. But again, if we try to establish a windbreak with a single species, that's not natural. And so other plants move in and fill in open areas within that windbreak. And so, you know, if it's a small windbreak, a person could spread mulch to try to reduce the establishment of new trees. If you get in a larger windbreak, that may not be cost effective. And so, you know, for a windbreak with a few volunteer trees, such as a mulberry or something, moving in. You know, I tend to think just going out and removing them by hand would be the simplest approach. Fortunately, you know, a lot of our trees don't produce, you know, thousands of seeds like some of our annual weeds do. So there, you'd have fewer plants in there, and so controlling them by hand is relatively simple from my perspective. Now, if you're the person that has a windbreak, you may not view that as simple.
When, for example, my parents have a reconstructed prairie, there's a lot of Russian olive that has made its way into their prairie. And this is a large acreage, you know, so it's difficult to go in and remove something like that by hand. Even if you do remove it by hand, it seems that new sprouts are coming up all the time. What do you do if you remove it by hand? Do you have a system to make sure that plant is actually dead?
Yeah, there are herbicide treatments that you can apply to the cut surface. So after you remove the tree, you have a little squirt bottle of a herbicide. And in the winter, I like to go out on the university golf course here and remove invasive brush that invades the woodlands on the golf course. And I just carry a squirt bottle of dilute Roundup. And so after I cut the tree down, then I just squirt a little bit of the Roundup on the stump. And the benefit of that is that it greatly reduces the resprouting from that stump, because a lot of our, especially the weedy species of trees, are very adept at resprouting. And so you gain very little by just cutting them off and walking away.
So, and if you apply Roundup to the stump, then it sort of gets sucked down into the root system? Or how does that
work? Right. It moves down in the roots. And so the benefit of that type of treatment is that you're, you know, greatly limiting the amount of herbicide that is used. If you go out there and try to spray a tree, the foliage, you have a lot of drift of the herbicide that's going to affect the native prairie plants. And so this cut surface treatment greatly reduces the amount of herbicide. There's other herbicides than glyphosate that can be used, but I like to use glyphosate just because there's less probability of it being absorbed by other plants in the area. And so there's the risk of damaging some of the desirable plants is less than with some of the other herbicides.
A lot of the invasive species that we find ourselves battling now, for example, multiflora rose or honeysuckle, these are plants that we brought into the environment on purpose a generation or two generations ago. What makes a plant an invasive species?
The definition of an invasive species is that it's exotic, and so that means it's not native to North America. And plants have always moved around the continent. And so the invasive expert sort of arbitrarily, you know, I think the date is like 1700. So any plant that existed in North America prior to the 1700s is considered invasive, exotic. Whereas if it was introduced after that point of time, either by humans or through some other natural dispersal process, it's considered an exotic exotic plant. Shouldn't say invasive, because the majority of exotic plants that get introduced into our country don't have what it takes to become a problem. And there's what they call the rules of 10, that 10% of any plants that are brought over either accidentally or purposely will escape into the wild. Of those, 10% will become established, and of those 10% will become invasive. So if you do the math, that's one out of 1,000 plants that get introduced to North America may become invasive.
Now, of course, some of those one out of 1,000 plants have really caused a lot of problems in Iowa and all over the United States. Now that we know more about invasive species and we see what can happen when some of these plants move into our environments, is there a way for us to know before a plant gets introduced as, say, an ornamental grass or something like that, that it has the potential to be an invasive species?
Yes, there's a whole science of identifying the traits that allow a plant to act as a weed. And so that's what we try to do now is characterize plants, determine what the risk is. Still, it's a hit and miss, but we do have a good idea. There is a federal noxious weed list that identifies plants that are believed to pose a threat. And so there are quarantines against bringing those plants into the country. So we are more knowledgeable than in the past. And so the likelihood of new bad actors getting introduced is less. But we still, because of the increase global trade, global travel, it's difficult to keep everything in place. And so there's always a risk of accidentally introducing new plants.
We're going to open the phones here in just a moment at 866-780-9100 with your questions about weeds or other plants in your life. But before we get to the break, Bob, I want to ask you about milkweed, because you have been studying milkweed, and that's a really unusual and very special plant in our environment because it supports monarch butterflies and really has a unique relationship with them, right?
Right. That's I think most people are aware of the migratory habit of the monarchs, makes it a very unique organism, and it only lays its eggs on members of the milkweed family, and the larvae require those milkweeds in order to develop. And prior to colonization of Iowa in the Midwest, there are a large number of milkweed species that the monarch butterfly used, but when we converted the prairie into corn and soybean fields, common milkweed was the best adapted species. And so now common milkweed is the dominant food source for the larvae of monarchs in the Midwest. And the primary habitat for that milkweed is the corn and soybean fields. And with the introduction of the Roundup Ready cropping systems, farmers have achieved a higher level of control of the milkweed, and so we've basically decimated the milkweed that exists in the corn and soybean fields.
So we're going to take a short break, but we can talk a little bit more about milkweed when we get back. And a lot of people are being encouraged to allow milkweed to grow on their property now. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. We'll also be taking your questions, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here, along with Bob Hartzler, ISU Extension weed specialist. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Bob Hartzler, Iowa State University Extension weed specialist, and joining the conversation now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And are you starting to get foliage in Ames? Because the trees are still pretty bare here in Iowa City.
We are getting a few things start to bloom. Some of the early things like forsythia, cornelian cherry dogwood, some of the magnolias are beginning to pop. And I'm guessing over the next few days, a lot of things will pop. So
yes, I'm hoping.
I think it's finally spring.
I'm hoping by Monday the world will be even greener.
Yes.
All right. You are welcome to join our conversation today with your phone calls at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And before we get to our first call, Bob, I want to return to the subject of milkweed, because there have been a lot of people asking for homeowners to incorporate milkweed into their lawns and their environments. Do you think that there is some progress being made there?
Yeah, I think every little milkweed has to help. There still is a lot of milkweed in the roadsides of Iowa. Those are highly populated by milkweeds. But one of the things the entomologists found when they started studying this issue is that the milkweeds, or the monarchs, seem to prefer to lay their eggs on milkweeds that occurred within cornfields for whatever reason. And if you look at some of the milkweeds that occur, especially along gravel roads, they don't look very appetizing because they're covered with dust and so forth. So I think planting any milkweed, and it doesn't have to be, you know, common milkweed. There's several ornamental varieties that the monarchs also use. And I'm sure Richard probably can name off several species that would do very well in a garden.
All right. Well, let's get to the phones, and we can talk more about milkweed if our callers want us to this hour. But you can call us at 866-780-9100. Cheryl is on the line first from Des Moines. Hi, Cheryl. Cheryl, are you there? We have the phones up. Cheryl, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi there.
Hi. Yes, we have 10 acres of timber, and we have buckeyes that are just growing rampant. We have them from little sprouts all the way up to 20-foot tall trees. And I know we're going to have to cut them down, but, I mean, I guess, do you have any suggestions on the process, or especially the huge ones?
Okay. Now, the Ohio buckeye is actually native to Iowa, much of southeastern Iowa. So it is a native tree. It has the typical fruit, the large, dark, shiny brown seeds. So it actually is a native plant. It's not really considered a weed.
Are you referring to buckthorn?
No, I think it's the buckeye tree. We did some research on it, and we're pretty sure it's the buckeye tree.
Okay.
And I guess it's just kind of overtaking the forest. We wouldn't mind having a few of them, but they're so growing, and they're kind of taking over, like where we have some oaks and maples and other hardwoods.
Okay. What you might want to do is contact your district forester, the DNR district forester, where they can come out to your area. They can inspect that area and maybe give you some recommendations as far as what to do. So I would contact your district forester in Iowa. And if you go to the Department of Natural Resources, if you go to forestry, they do list the district foresters in Iowa. I think there's like 14 or 15.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Cheryl. And let's go next to Lynn on the line in Ames. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I purchased some hanging baskets yesterday, and I wondered, they've got snapdragons and begonias, and I wondered what kind of nighttime temperatures I need to have in order to leave them out.
Well, you could leave them out if it's going to be 40 or above, but if you purchase those from a greenhouse, the first thing you want to do is to put them outside on a northern exposure, where they're basically in complete shade.
Oh.
Because if they were grown in a greenhouse, the light intensity outdoors is much, much higher.
Okay.
And if you put them in direct sun immediately, they're going to burn.
Okay.
That sun will actually destroy some of the chlorophyll in the tissue. So put them outside, but put them in the shade.
Okay.
Also out of the wind, because it's very windy today,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of tender. But if it's going to be 40 or above, they can stay outside. If there's any hint of a frost or freeze, then they come in that evening.
Yeah, I knew frost or freeze, but I
But as long as it's above 40, they're fine.
40. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Lynn. Mm-hmm. And Richard, how long would you want them to stay in the shade before you can move them to wherever you want?
Yeah, I would leave them there for maybe a day or two and then gradually expose them to some direct sun. So after about maybe 5, 6, 7 days, then they can go in direct sun, full sun.
I'm sure that is a very common problem for people to just put them. Because, of course, you have your spot where you want to hang your basket. You bring it home and you just want to put it there.
Right. You think, well, it's growing in a greenhouse, plenty of light. But outside, the light intensity is much, much higher.
Interesting. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Carol is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I have a question about, I have several, I don't know if they're junipers or some sort of evergreen plants, that are about 6 feet tall, three of them in my yard. And, of course, they got damaged by that heavy snow where, you know, it just kind of it split them apart. So now mm-hmm. they're sort of growing in two shapes upward. And they're really unsightly, but they're quite established plants. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if I should take them out and start over or if there's some way to repair them.
Well, if they're not broken, I would take some fairly wide straps or maybe pieces of old nylon stocking and try tying them together, see if that works. And if that works, great. But you want something that is fairly wide so it's not going to cut into the actual stems. And I would try that and see if it works. And if that doesn't work, maybe replace them next year.
Carol, thanks a lot for your call. And Richard, I've seen so many people pulling out arborvitae
yes.
and all kinds of evergreens. It seems like our drought followed by a pretty serious winter was just enough to do a lot of them in.
Yeah. I would say the last 4 or 5 years are really hard on the evergreens. We had the very wet years in 2009, 2010, and then we had the extreme drought and heat of last year. And they simply, many of them simply could not cope with that. So we saw a lot of arborvitae dying last year, even well-established plants that were maybe 20, 25 feet tall. So when you have those extremes, that can cause quite a bit of stress and eventual death. So,
and I know you recommend the Techne arborvitae. Do you know if they did better than others?
I'm not sure better, but it's still, I think, probably one of the better varieties. We did have reports of even that dying, so it kind of depends upon the soil type that you have. Was it well-drained, poorly drained, and things like that. So there were factors involved, but it was the last 4 or 5 years have been tough for the evergreens.
All right. Let's get to some of these email questions. This is from David. I have several swamp white oak and maple trees that were planted 1 to 2 years ago. They've not yet begun to bud, but several other trees in my yard have. Are these dead or just late starters?
I think they're late starters. It's still early. This year we're behind schedule. Last week we were way ahead. So if they haven't leafed out or begun to leaf out by mid-May, then I would be concerned. But that's maybe 3 weeks in the future.
All right. So. Harlow writes from Solon, my front lawn is over my well, so I don't like using pesticides. It is in partial shade, and due to a slope, it tends to erode. I'm tired of mowing weeds. What ground cover would you recommend?
Oh, ground cover. Well, there are possibilities. Lily of the Valley is a possibility. It's a very aggressive ground cover. Grows in basically part to full shade. You could try creeping lily turf. That also spreads. You could try spotted dead nettle, sweet woodruff, or you could go with a native ground cover like maybe wild ginger.
So lots of interesting options. Yeah. All right, let's get back to the phones. And next up, we've got Dan on the line in Coralville. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I live in a house that's been here 100 years, and we've always enjoyed our Jack in the Pulpit. Now, they make a red pyramid in the fall, and I wonder if I wanted to plant those seeds, should I put them in October or dry them out and put them in April?
Right. Basically, what you want to do is as soon as they turn that bright orangey red, then remove that cluster of berry-like fruit and squeeze out the seeds. I think there's several seeds per berry-like fruit. And then plant those in the fall about a quarter inch deep because
okay.
they need to be exposed to the cold temperatures and moisture before they can germinate. And try to do that in kind of a damp or wet area because that's what they like as far as an environment.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a
Thank
lot for
you.
Your call, Dan. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and ISU Extension weed specialist Bob Hartzler. And we're going to talk about mulberries here now. Rachel is on the line from Newton. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
Well, my great-grandfather's grave has this reoccurring mulberry bush that keeps growing out from underneath it. And we've cut it back it seems like forever, and it still stays there.
And it's growing from under the stone?
Yeah, like on the corner of the stone. It grows every year. And we have some other flowers that we've planted out there as well that we want to keep, but we don't want the mulberry. So how do we get rid of it without killing everything else?
Good question. All right. Bob? Yeah.
So that's where I think the cut surface treatment is a great option. And glyphosate is the most readily available and the safest product sold as Roundup. And usually it depends on the species, but you want to dilute the product about 50%, so one part water, one part of the herbicide. And then immediately after you cut the tree, you can use a paintbrush or a squirt bottle and just paint or squirt that herbicide around the bark. You don't need to do the entire stump because the majority of the internal wood is dead tissue. So you just need to do the cambium layer, which is just on the inside of the bark. And so it doesn't take much herbicide, and it greatly reduces the resprouting, and that can be done any time of the year. Probably want to avoid in the early spring when it's just starting to leaf out, because you'll get less movement down in the root system. But that would be the simplest way to deal with that.
And again, if you just apply it to the stump, you're not going to damage the other plants around it, right?
Correct.
All right. And I think you probably have a similar question or a similar answer for Jeff in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Yes. I agree that's the best way to get rid of mulberries is to cut them down. They're terrible trees. They're so brittle, and they broke a lot of limbs under heavy snow this winter, so we're going to have to keep at it. And what I need to do is somehow identify the little sprouts that come up of mulberries, because pull them out right now and all that. But my other concern is my lawn in Des Moines is so stressed out, and there are areas, it's an older lawn that maybe have a lot of thatch built up, but there's some dead areas that are in the lawn, and do I rake all that and reseed, and when do I reseed, because it's too cool at night until it's maybe 60 degrees at night and 75, and then keep watering it?
Well, it, you can sow grass seed in the spring. It's not as easy as late summer. Late summer actually is the best time. But you can do it this spring. If the area is fairly small, you could go out with a lawn rake and simply rake the area. Okay. And the purpose in doing that is to break the soil surface a little bit.
Yeah.
And then go ahead and sow your grass seed.
Like bluegrass?
If you have plenty of sun, that's basically going to be Kentucky bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
And then rake it a second time to work the seed into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then keep the seed bed moist by watering frequently but lightly, just to keep the upper inch of soil moist. Okay?
Should I put down some Excelsior or something to just keep it under a blanket, let's say, or keep it moist?
Well, if it were, for example, basically bare ground.
Yeah.
Let's say it's just bare ground. There's no grass there whatsoever.
Yeah.
You can go to garden centers. You can go to other retailers, and they have these soil erosion mats that you can basically place over the area and then pin them to the ground, and that basically conserves soil moisture, and then the grass comes right up through that actual mat.
Yeah.
And so you can buy these at garden centers and other retailers, big box stores.
Yeah. As we know, last summer was just terrible. And well, I was trying to germinate and plant grass seed, and the dew points were so low and so cold, it just never worked out.
Well,
and
the key there with the grass seed is that when you sow grass seed, in your mind, you should say to yourself, I'm going to have to water. It's not going to rain often enough for the grass seed to germinate. And so you really do have to go with that mindset. I'm going to have to water maybe once or twice a day, and do that for maybe 2 or 3 weeks if it doesn't rain. So,
all right. Well, good luck with that, Jeff. And let's take another email question, and we'll at least start it before we get to the break. This is from Lori in Des Moines. I've tried to kill and remove poison ivy from my backyard. Even though it's black and leafless, it still makes me break out and itch. What's the best way to get rid of it? Bob?
You find somebody who's not allergic to it and have them come dig it out. But yeah, that's a tough one. If you're highly allergic to it, like some people are, it's really best to have someone else do that for you. The again, I'm a big fan of the cut surface treatment, and with poison ivy, a lot of times you'll have a few large main vines, and if you can find where those are at and cut them off at the surface, and again, paint that surface, that's going to be more effective than trying to spray it. There are herbicides that you can use, a foliar application, and I think Ortho actually has a product called Poison Ivy Be Gone or something like that, and those can work, and that way with those you don't need to handle the plant like you would with a cut surface treatment.
All right. Well, long sleeves and gloves might help a little bit too.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm talking with Bob Hartzler and Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and ISU Extension weed specialist Bob Hartzler. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Lori is up next. Hello, Lori.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 30-foot square army of little 2-foot-tall thorny locust trees on a natural prairie real close to a ravine, and I'm pretty chemical-averse. So what would you suggest?
If they're 2 feet tall, they should be not have a thick enough bark to tolerate burning. So if there's enough fuel to burn that, I think that should be the most effective way. You can go in there and mow them. The smaller trees are less prone to resprout. So I think either burning or mowing would be the best two options probably.
All right, Lori, does that answer your question?
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yes, thank
Thanks
you
a lot.
So much.
Good luck.
All right.
All right, next up we'll go to David on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, in past falls, I've usually been able to harvest 400 to 600 pounds of hen in the woods mushrooms. But because of the drought last year, they were almost non-existent. And I'm wondering if that's going to affect their regeneration this year.
I'm not sure. That's a little bit out of my area. And Bob is laughing, too. So
so we may not be able to answer that
we
one
We can
today,
answer
David.
That. We're not sure.
Call us back in the fall and let us know. Then we'll know. We'll know for next time.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for the effort.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, David. Cheryl's on the line next in Marshalltown. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What's your question?
I have established a flower bed about 4 or 5 years ago. I have it cedar mulched. I get volunteer plants coming up through there in the hundreds in a certain area. They start about June, and they last all summer long if I don't constantly pull them out. I do have a rose of Sharon bush in there that really is more like a tree. It's a single trunk and about 8 feet tall. Could those volunteer plants be rose of Sharon starting?
What do you think? Richard? Oh, we seem to have lost our connection to Ames. Oh, there you are. Richard?
I didn't hear the last part.
Oh, okay. Well, there was somehow there was a disconnect. So she's got a Rose of Sharon bush in this landscaped flower bed, and she's got these volunteer plants coming up, and she's wondering if they're suckers from the Rose of Sharon.
No, because that is a plant that does
Oh, we lost Richard again. Okay. So, Cheryl.
Not Rose of Sharon.
Okay, so. Not Rose of Sharon.
Nope.
Cheryl, do you have a follow-up?
No, that's it.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. And hopefully we get to keep you now, Richard, because I can't answer these questions. Frank is up next on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have just made a 5x12 garden, stripped off facade, added in 2 to 3 year old goat manure and 10 bags of organic black soil. And we are wondering if we have enough, if that's the right soil mix and how we tell if we don't.
Well, what I would do is work that into the soil thoroughly, incorporate that into the upper, let's say, 8 to 10 inches of soil, and then plant things and see how they do. And if that's basically how you're going to do it. You can't tell exactly, but I think that's a good starting point. But go ahead and plant, and if the things grow just fine, or let's say you go out there later on this summer and you're doing some cultivating or whatever, and you find the ground is still quite hard and it's cracking, then that would suggest maybe you need some more organic matter. So if the plants don't produce well, if you notice the soil is still heavy, it's cracking, then I would add some more organic matter then next fall.
I see. Okay. So nothing. Start from where we are and add next year.
Right. So I would add, let's say, 1 or 2 inches of organic matter, work it in, see how things do, and then if I'm still not happy, work in another inch or two in the fall.
What, when you say organic matter, what do you mean?
Organic matter would be anything such as compost, barnyard manure, sphagnum peat moss, but basically, it's basically decomposed plant material or something of that nature.
So, and we've already added the manure, so are you saying add some more? Or
I would basically just go ahead and plant things at this point and then see how they perform and see how the soil reacts. And then if you think it's just not good enough yet, then I would add some more this coming fall, like in October.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot for your call. We've got a couple of lines open for your question at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's get back to the email now. Mary is on the line, Mary wrote us from Des Moines. She said, I have a patch of grass in my front yard. It faces straight south, but we have trees that will shade it by late afternoon. I can't get grass to grow there and have tried everything, seed, patch, etc. It sits at the southern base of a very old maple tree, so I'm wondering if that's the problem. But I don't have problems growing grass on the other sides of the tree. What do you think?
Well, maple trees tend to be very, very strong competitors. They have an enormous root system. It's very shallow. And so it's very difficult for grasses to grow underneath maple trees. What they could try is try certain species of grass. The fine leaf fescues, things like creeping red fescue, hard fescue, chewings fescue, they do best in the shade. Bluegrass does not. So they could try sowing some shade-tolerant grasses. I would probably try doing that in early spring, where you go out and you kind of lightly rake the soil surface and then sow your grass seed and then rake that seed into the soil and then keep the seed bed moist. It should come up. The key is keeping it long term. That's going to be the problem, but at least I would try that.
All right, and here's another email from Shalise. I have an issue with a trumpet vine that has taken over. I've cut back, dug up, and tried many other things to destroy it. It is now growing under the concrete, under the steps to the house. What can I do to remove it permanently?
Persistence in cutting it back. If you, you know, over the course of a year, sometimes with certain perennials, it'll take more than a year. But if you prevent it from establishing foliage, that will eventually deplete the energy reserves that are in that root system.
This is a long-term project. Trumpet vine is a really very tenacious plant. It doesn't give up easily. So plan on this for maybe 2 or 3 years.
Right. This is what Donald Lewis would refer to as a new hobby, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Eldon is on the line from Atkins. Hi, Eldon.
Good morning, and certainly enjoying your program.
Great. What's your question?
One about a persimmon. It is a cultivated variety, and about the top third of it got twisted off last summer in a storm. And how would you recommend I try to retrain it for a leader?
How tall is it?
It's roughly about 7-8 feet tall.
Okay.
It remains, and about the top third of it was twisted off, and it does have rather long branches.
Okay. Well, what you could actually do maybe is if there is a branch that is close to being vertical, maybe you could pound in a stake next to the trunk of the tree and then pull that branch upright so it becomes the leader of that tree. So that would be a possibility where you kind of encourage the tree to develop a new leader.
And would you do anything to the broken area, just leave it the way it is, or
I would prune
maybe square it off?
Yeah, I would prune it back at a logical point on the tree. So I would go back to a branch or side branch and make the cut there.
Okay. If I have time for a second question?
Sure, quickly.
I have a new pear that I want to plant, and when I got it from the nursery, it's a semi-dwarf, and I'm assuming there is a place where it's been grafted to a rootstock.
Mm-hmm.
That needs to be above ground?
Correct. The graft union, typically you can find that because there's kind of a crook in the stem at the very base where
yes.
the grafting was done. And so you want to make sure the graft union is just above the ground.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Eldon. And let's go next to Elmer on the line in Jewel. Hi, Elmer.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have every year, it seems like, I don't know if you call it Creeping Jenny or Creeping Charlie, but I'm trying to get rid of it without damaging the rest of the lawn and other plants that I'm planting.
Yeah, the Creeping Charlie is one of the most aggressive plants, and once it gets established, it actually, you know, crowds out the turf grass species.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have tried using borax, but that's sort of marginally effective. The dandelion type herbicides, if you apply those in the fall, you don't actually kill the Creeping Charlie as much as weaken it, and so then you hope that the winter takes it out. And so if you can do two applications spread maybe 3 weeks apart in late September and then in October, that weakens the Creeping Charlie enough, again, that the winter finishes it off because it has a very shallow root system.
Okay. And now what was that again? I didn't hear what the herbicide was.
There's several products. Weed Be Gone, Trimec. If you can find one that has triclopyr in it, if you look at the ingredient label,
okay.
that tends to be a little bit more effective. But there's okay. a large number of products that are sold for controlling broadleaves in lawns.
Okay, and it won't destroy the rest of the lawn.
No. Sometimes the Creeping Charlie is so dense that there's little grass left. And in that situation, you're best off just starting from scratch. And the Creeping Charlie is very sensitive to a Roundup. And so you can spray that area earlier in the late summer and then reseed, and you may have better luck there. But if there's still a good stand of grass amongst the Creeping Charlie, then you're best trying to, you know, selectively remove it.
All right, Elmer, good luck with that. And Phyllis is on the line next from Davenport. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. I would like to grow milkweed in several locations. I have a couple questions. I'm in Davenport, so would seed, or can I use seed, or do I have to actually buy plants and plant them here?
Well, you can buy some of the milkweeds that are ornamental. You can buy those at garden centers. Things like butterfly weed, which is actually an ornamental. It's a milkweed. It's native to Iowa, and so you can actually buy it. It has a very attractive orange flower, fits in very nicely in a perennial bed. You can also buy swamp milkweed. It's also native to Iowa. And you can actually buy those plants. As far as the common milkweed, you'll probably have to start that from seed.
And if I do that, I have a fairly large area. I don't suppose I can just broadcast it. Do I have to, till first and then plant it?
Yeah, if you plant seeds, you'd want to disturb the soil either with a hoe or a rake and then kind of rake the seed into the soil.
Do you think that it will grow on a north-facing slope, or does it need more sun than that?
The milkweeds typically like plenty of sun, so I would say at least 6 hours of direct sun per day at least.
All right. Well, Phyllis, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to John on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, John.
Yeah, Charity, I have a question. I have a row windbreak of arborvita, the emerald green arborvita. I got them through the drought last year, so they're still going. Will it hurt them to kind of give them a spray of miracid or something like that to kind of fertilize them to get them a little better start this year?
Yeah, that's not really going to help that much. Typically in Iowa, we have good fertile soil, so fertilization isn't really necessary. If I was going to fertilize them, I would probably go to my local garden center and buy like a 10-10-10 and just walk down the row and just kind of broadcast it down the sides.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, John. And next up, let's see if we can squeeze in Les before we get to the end of the show. Hi, Les.
Yeah. My question is, when in the spring would you burn restoring prairie to cut back on the broom grass?
Okay. I'm not an expert on prairie burns, but I think as soon as it's dry enough to get a good burn, and you want to make sure you know what you're doing, you have the equipment to contain the fire.
Right.
But before you see new growth.
Now?
And yes. Les, how big an acreage are you burning?
There's probably 3 or 4 acres total, but I just burn small parts at a time.
Well, you might want to get in touch with the Prairie Center at University of Northern Iowa and ask some questions, because we may be past the burning opportunity for the spring, but I know some people do fall burns, so that may be an opportunity as well, but you just may have to wait a little while. And we're almost out of time, but Craig in Cedar Rapids has a question. He wants to know if milkweed and milk thistle are the same thing.
They're not the same thing, and milk thistle is not a member of the milkweed family. If it's a milk thistle, I'm thinking of. Common names are always dangerous because.
Right.
but there is a milk thistle that's in the Asteraceae family.
All right. And I'll squeeze in one more question. This one's from David in Ames. He's bought some holly to put in his landscaping in Ames, and it didn't make it through the summer or the winter, apparently. He's wondering if it's possible to grow holly in the landscape in central Iowa.
We can. Basically, it's a certain type. Things like China Boy, China Girl, Blue Prince, Blue Princess, they are actually quite hardy. Some of the other ones are not. So look for those.
All right. Richard Geron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and Bob Hartzler, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Bob Hartzler, ISU Extension Weed Specialist. We'll be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, we'll meet the winner of this year's State Poetry Out Loud competition. He performed his poems in American Sign Language.